arm of war. Crash follows hard on crash. The whole land is laid waste. Suddenly my tents are laid waste, my curtains in a moment. In spite of imposing obstacles, Jeremiah had remained true to his message from God that Babylonian captivity and destruction were certainly coming. About 100 years, or a little over 100 years before this was happening in Jerusalem, Isaiah had consoled the citizens of Jerusalem with promises that God would intervene and that the powerful Sennacherib would not conquer and overthrow the city. It is certainly what Zedekiah was hoping to hear from Jeremiah now, 130 years later. But that's not the message of Jeremiah. What Jeremiah says to Zedekiah is this: prepare war against her. Arise and let us attack at noon. Woe to us, for the day declines, for the shadows of evening lengthen. Jerusalem had for a long time witnessed the titanic struggle of two egocentric nations for domination of the ancient world, Babylon and Egypt, with Jerusalem, unfortunately, geographically situated right in between. Since the death of Josiah, Jerusalem had continually rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, and therefore Jeremiah was repeatedly imprisoned in an attempt to silence his subversive activities and to prevent his influential agitation in the military ranks for the Jewish troops to surrender to the uncircumcised Chaldeans. The citizens and leaders of Jerusalem could not believe that Jeremiah was preaching that this monster, Nebuchadnezzar, was actually the servant of God and was being sent by God to destroy the city of Jerusalem. The Old Testament depicts Zedekiah as a weak and evil king. We're told in 2 Chronicles chapter 36 and verse 12 that he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord his God. He did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet, who spoke from the mouth of the Lord. But to his credit, at least near the end, Zedekiah recognized, even secretly, because he didn't want the princes and the rulers to know, Zedekiah recognized that Jeremiah was the last hope for the nation. And so he asked Jeremiah for this message from God. We're told in Jeremiah chapter 37 and verse 17, King Zedekiah sent for him and received him. The king questioned him secretly in his house and said, "Is there any word from the Lord?" In chapter 38 and verse 2, "Thus says the Lord," as Jeremiah responds, "He who stays in this city shall die by the sword, by famine, and by pestilence. But he who goes out to the Chaldeans shall live. He shall have his life as a prize of war and live." And then skipping down to verse 14 in chapter 38, King Zedekiah sent for Jeremiah the prophet and received him at the third entrance of the temple of the Lord. The king said to Jeremiah, "I will ask you a question. Hide nothing from me." Jeremiah said to Zedekiah, "If I tell you, will you not surely put me to death? And if I give you counsel, you will not listen to me." Then King Zedekiah swore secretly to Jeremiah, "As the Lord lives, who made our souls, I will not put you to death or deliver you into the hand of these men who seek your life." Then Jeremiah said to Zedekiah, "Thus says the Lord, the God of hosts, the God of Israel, if you will surrender to the officials of the king of Babylon, then your life shall be spared, and this city shall not be burned with fire, and you and your house shall live. But if you do not surrender to the officials of the king of Babylon, then this city shall be given into the hands of the Chaldeans, and they shall burn it with fire, and you shall not escape from their hand." It came to pass that with the final fall of Jerusalem to Nebuchadnezzar's battering rams and storming machines, the young King Zedekiah was captured. And he was brought before the Babylonian authorities in Riblah, at the upper end of the Valley of Lebanon. And there a horrible thing happened. He was required to watch his young sons slain. And it would prove to be the last thing that he ever saw. Because his eyes, right after the killing of these young boys, almost certainly children, the last thing that he saw was their death, and then his eyes were put out as well. Zedekiah was only 32 years old when this happened. Very much a young person. We're told that he was 21 when he came to the throne. And he'd been on the throne, having been placed there by Nebuchadnezzar, for 11 years. The Bible doesn't tell us all the particulars, but Josephus says that his children were young enough that they were still under the care of their mothers at the time that they were killed. Josephus also tells us, as we know from other sources, that Zedekiah later dies in Babylon. And that brings us to the end of that particular story, the end of the story of Zedekiah. But it's not the end of the story for Jeremiah. In contrast to the treatment of Zedekiah, the prophet Jeremiah was freed from all bondage and rewarded well for his efforts in warning the citizens of Jerusalem to surrender. It's already been pointed out what an amazing thing it was that Nebuchadnezzar knew of Jeremiah and appreciated what Jeremiah had done in trying to convince the Israelites to surrender. And so Jeremiah is treated courteously by the Babylonians. He's rewarded, and he is entrusted for safety to Gedaliah, who was appointed as a ruler over those who were not taken into exile. We read this in chapter 40, beginning in verse 1. The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord after Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, had let him go from Ramah. When he took him bound in chains along with all the captives of Jerusalem and Judah who were being exiled to Babylon, the captain of the guard took Jeremiah and said to him, "The Lord your God pronounced this disaster against this place. The Lord has brought it about and has done as he said. Because you sinned against the Lord and did not obey His voice, this thing has come upon you. Now behold, I release you today from the chains on your hands. If it seems good to you, come to me, come with me to Babylon. Come, and I will look after you well. But if it seems wrong to you to come with me to Babylon, do not come. See, the whole land is before you. Go wherever you think it is good and right to go. If you remain, then return to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, whom the king of Babylon appointed governor of the cities of Judah, and dwell with him among the people, or go wherever you think it right to go." So the captain of the guard gave him an allowance of food and a present and let him go. Then Jeremiah went to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, at Mizpah, and lived with him among the people who were left in the land. Shortly after this, just a matter of months, Gedaliah was killed. And soon after that, Jeremiah was taken by the rebels with them to Egypt, in spite of the fact that he had warned them that it was God's will for them to remain in Palestine. And that's the last that we know of Jeremiah, other than a prophecy that he made while he was in Tophanes. In Jeremiah chapter 43, at Tophanes, Jeremiah warned his people in a symbolic message that God would send Nebuchadnezzar into Egypt to execute judgment. In chapter 44, Jeremiah reminded the people that Jerusalem was in ruins and that God's judgment had come upon them because they had ignored the messages of warning delivered through the prophets. Judah had become a curse and a byword among the nations because she had provoked God to anger. The people, however, were not moved by Jeremiah's message and warnings, even in Egypt, after all they had seen. They claimed that this evil had come upon them because they had ceased to worship the Queen of Heaven. It is likely that Jeremiah died in Egypt among a people who were still not willing to repent, although nothing is known about that with any certainty. What do we know about Jeremiah the man? When we think about Jeremiah the man, which is my assignment, to say something about him as a person, and something about the work that he's done, and something about his life that can be of assistance and help to us. Jeremiah was, or is, continues to be almost universally known as the weeping prophet. And that might be based on what he said in chapter 9 and verse 1 about his wish to have a fountain of tears with which he might weep for the slain of his own people. It is this trait of deep empathy for those he continually chastises that differentiates him from many of the other prophets. This profound emotional connection that Jeremiah maintains with his people leads him to astonishing admissions of personal grief, anguish, fury, as he describes what it is like to do the work of God for 40 plus years and to receive in return little more than condemnation and hatred from those to whom he has been sent to announce the instructions of God. Jeremiah was born into the priestly family of Hilkiah. Some may disagree with this. I think almost certainly not the same Hilkiah, the high priest who found the law, discovered the law in the temple. Although that is a possibility, and there are some commentators who take that position. He was born in the city of Anathoth, near Jerusalem, which was only a few miles from Jerusalem, but within the borders of Benjamin. And this city had been assigned to the Levites under Joshua. We read that in Joshua chapter 21 and verse 18. Another famous priest, Abiathar, who served as a priest under David, was also from Anathoth. I discovered that there's a lot of conjecture about what Jeremiah's name means. And that was a little surprising to me. I ran across a number of different possibilities, and I listed some of them in the outline. The Lord will restore. Yahweh shall exalt, or Yahweh shall lift up. Yahweh loosens. Yahweh throws or casts down. He lifts up or casts down. The Lord establishes. The Lord sends whom Jehovah appoints. It's really difficult to know precisely what the name means. And again, a lot of difference of judgment among the commentators about what it exactly means. We know that, and it's already been mentioned, we know that Jeremiah was called as a young man, almost certainly a teenager. And he was told that he would be opposed from the very beginning. He was forbidden to marry, which is amazing to me when you consider that the work that he does for God lasts for over 40 years. There's not a man in this room I know who can imagine what it would be like to do the work that you try to do without your wife by your side. And yet from a very young man, Jeremiah is told by God that he's not allowed to marry. As we've already been told, he's not even allowed to mourn or attend mourning. He's not allowed to be a part of feasts. He is forbidden on more than one occasion to pray even. I'll say more about that toward the end of the lesson. The citizens of his own hometown tried to kill him. And as if that weren't bad enough, the officials and the citizens of the city of Jerusalem joined in the efforts to kill him as well. He was on occasion confronted by the false prophets. He was cursed. He was beaten, put in stocks, and denounced. His teaching was vehemently opposed. He was imprisoned on more than one occasion. He was beaten. He was thrown into a dungeon or a cistern. He was bound in chains, and he was falsely accused. Consequently, the life of, I think, very few other prophets, if any, reflects the history of his times as vividly as the life of Jeremiah reflects the times, the situation, the circumstances, what life was like, what was going on in the city of Jerusalem leading up to the Babylonian captivity. Jeremiah is recognized as a somber and sometimes even depressed spirit. I want to show you a picture. I think it's the next picture after this, which is impressive to me. This is Michelangelo's depiction of Jeremiah in the frescoes on the Sistine Chapel. And it seems to me as though looking at that picture, I'll give you a little bit closer view of it, and I'm not sure how well you can see it. And maybe some of you have been there and seen it with your own eyes. But many scholars, including a number of scholars who have no special interest in spiritual things or biblical things, would suggest that in terms of what we know biblically about this particular prophet, this is Michelangelo's most vivid depiction of a Bible character, most accurate depiction of a Bible character. He paints Jeremiah as the prophet of myrrh, which is an exceptionally bitter spice. He's represented bent over like a tottering pillar from the temple. His head is supported by his right hand. His beard is disordered, which expresses a time of very intense sorrow. And if you look very closely, his forehead is scored with wrinkles. I don't see very many wrinkles in foreheads around the room. Michelangelo got it right, I think. His eyes seem to see blood and ruins. One scholar says his lips appear to murmur lament. The whole picture strikingly portrays a man who seldom in his life had occasion to laugh. As a matter of fact, it's almost difficult to imagine Jeremiah laughing, is it not? And I don't think there's any depiction of him involved in any kind of scene that would involve joy anywhere in the book of Jeremiah. And again, we're talking about someone who preached, someone who prophesied, someone who worked for God diligently for over 40 years. What about Jeremiah's message? In Jeremiah chapter 1 and verse 10, I think right in the very beginning when Jeremiah is commissioned, we have an excellent summary of what Jeremiah's work was going to be. Jeremiah chapter 1 and verse 10, see, God says, I have set you this day over nations and over kingdoms to pluck up and to break down, to destroy and to overthrow, to build and to plant. That's the message of Jeremiah under broad headings. As you read the book of Jeremiah, and as you look at the history of Israel in the Kings and Chronicles accounts during this period of time, I think Jeremiah's message can be summed up under four general headings. First of all, condemnation. And this seems to be the prevailing message of Jeremiah. God had revealed His will to His people. He sent prophet after prophet after prophet. It's not a question of God failing to communicate His will to them. It's not a question of their being able to understand it. It had been clearly revealed to them. And yet they forsook God's law and walked in their own ways. And so Jeremiah teaches that sin must be punished. And as we talked about in one of the question and answer sessions earlier in the day, the sentence against Jerusalem and against Judah has already been pronounced, and it is a death sentence. On a number of occasions, Jeremiah used three terms to describe what was going to happen to Jerusalem: famine, pestilence, and sword. He saw that coming, but he didn't take any joy. He didn't take any pleasure in it. In one moving passage in Jeremiah chapter 4, verses 23 to 28, he compares the coming destruction of Jerusalem to the undoing of creation itself. And he says in chapter 8 that these deaths, and there would be many of them, these deaths would symbolize the failure of Judah and Jerusalem's false gods to save them. This would be the proof that the idols they worshipped were not really gods at all. Jeremiah's message was one primarily of condemnation. They have sinned, and they're going to be punished for it. But I would suggest to you, secondly, that Jeremiah's message, as we've also already discussed, is a message of invitation. We had a good discussion about that in one of the question and answer sessions. And it may come up again in this next question and answer session. But clearly, God, through Jeremiah, on a number of occasions in the book, promises deliverance from these punishments if the people would repent. Repentance would bring a blessing. And so Jeremiah preaches that. The people are called on to mend their ways. Not everybody in Judah was guilty. There were some good people in Jerusalem. some good people in Judah. Anyone who knew God and who knew Jeremiah to be his spokesman had options that led to safety during these trying times. But think about what the options were. What are the options that Jeremiah offers? Not life as usual. It didn't mean that there wouldn't be suffering. Anyone who believed Jeremiah's message, and I have to believe that there were people who did believe Jeremiah's message and did what Jeremiah told them to do, and that is leave the city and surrender to the Chaldeans. Now, that meant exile. That meant their homes would be lost. They would be leaving their businesses behind, probably be leaving almost all of their possessions behind. But it would mean that they would be alive. And it was a path of hope for some people. And so Jeremiah invited people to do exactly that. Go out of the city and surrender to the Chaldeans and be carried away into captivity. Zedekiah, of course, ignored that message. As a matter of fact, it seems as though most people in the city of Jerusalem ignored that message and had to suffer as a consequence famine, pestilence, and sword. But imagine how Jeremiah would be treated. Imagine how people, just the average person in the street, would feel about Jeremiah. Imagine, as horrible as it might be, that the United States is under siege. Maybe the city where you live is under siege, and somebody's walking through the streets saying, what you need to do is you need to lay down your weapons, and you just need to walk out with your hands up, waving a white flag, and just surrender, give up to them. It's not likely in this country that you would be allowed to live if you presented a message like that. You are a traitor. Better to stay here and starve. Better to stay here and die of disease. Better to stay here and be killed in battle than to surrender to the enemy. That's the message that Jeremiah is preaching. And so it doesn't take much imagination to understand how Jeremiah was being treated by the people in Jerusalem. It's also not hard to understand why Nebuchadnezzar thought so highly of Jeremiah. Not necessarily because Nebuchadnezzar respected Jeremiah's God, although we know that Nebuchadnezzar knew Jeremiah's God, right? But it had to be for a man in Nebuchadnezzar's position, laying siege to a fortified city on a hill, a siege that lasted for a long time. It had to be somewhat comforting to him to know, I've got somebody on the inside telling people it's hopeless. You need to surrender. You need to come out. That was Jeremiah's message. And the message was from God. This is what God is telling Jeremiah to present to the people. And so, his message was also an invitation. Not an invitation like we think about extending the invitation. An invitation to save your lives. Save your lives. This destruction is inevitable. I would suggest to you, though, number three, that it is also a message of consolation. Jeremiah's message contains bright messages, bright points of glory that will follow the doom. Judah would be restored. There are some important glimpses of the coming of the Messiah in Jeremiah's message, and I'm looking forward to Ben sharing some of his insights into that with us tomorrow. I'm thinking especially about Jeremiah chapter 31 and the announcement of the new covenant that God would set in place with His people. Both the epistle to the Romans and the epistle to the Hebrews elaborate on those important messages from the book of Jeremiah. But again, you think about what that message, how that message would have resonated with the people to whom he was preaching. Yeah. Hang in there. You know, 600 years from now, God's going to make everything all right. You know, the Messiah is going to come. A new covenant will be put in place. I doubt that it provided very much comfort to them, but at least it was a message of hope. And much sooner than that, he promised them that, again, Judah would be restored, that a remnant would come back and be returned. The fourth message is an important part of the book of Jeremiah, and I think, and it's already been mentioned, I think at least once and maybe more than once, but Jeremiah wrote some letters to the exiles. He wrote some letters to the exiles. In 605, a group of Jews from Jerusalem had been carried away into Babylonian exile. And of course, we know the names of some of those people who were carried away. In 597, 596, depending on how you date it, another considerably larger group of captives are carried away into Babylonian captivity. And I would suggest that God is using these first two waves to get things ready in Babylon for an exceptionally larger group of Jews who are going to eventually be joining them. And so Jeremiah writes comforting words to the exiles. If you read starting in about chapter 29 and on for the next several chapters, you read these letters, the tone of Jeremiah's message in these letters is considerably different than the message that he's preaching to the people who are still in Jerusalem. These letters are full of hope. They're full of promise. They're full of encouragement. These messages, these letters to the exiles, contain the promise of a return from Babylonian captivity, at least for some in 70 years. And I've always been impressed by this, that no matter which date you pin that you look at, the 70 years works both ways, or at least this is the way I've presented it. If you take it back to the first group who were carried away into exile, 606 BC, 536 is when Cyrus issued the decree to let the Jews come back home. You have 70 years. But you also, if you look at it from the actual time when the temple is destroyed, it's 70 years until 516 when the temple is finally completed. The foundation had already been laid, but the temple is finished in 517. I don't know if, I mean, maybe that's me reading more into some of those texts than are there. But that would have been important. I think that message would have resonated with the people. Some of us will survive this. Some of us might live long enough. And even if we don't, our children and our grandchildren will have the opportunity perhaps to go back and to live in Jerusalem again. And so when you think about the message of Jeremiah, it's a message that it started out with condemnation, but it's a message that also included hope. Some of this Cloyce has already discussed, and I won't go back into detail about it, but Jeremiah used a lot of different figures, a lot of different symbols to teach his message. You have the wearing, the burial, and the retrieval of that linen, what became the soiled waistband or girdle. The potter who takes a piece of clay and then reworks it, the breaking of the clay jug in front of the religious leaders in chapter 19, the wearing of the oxen yoke, and its subsequent breaking by a false prophet, Hananiah. The purchase of a field in Anathoth for the price of 17 silver shekels. He paid a lot of money for, as Cloyce said, for a worthless piece of land to demonstrate his conviction that God was going to restore the people to the land. And so Jeremiah uses a number. It's not just that he stands up in front of a group of people and talks. He uses symbols. He uses figures. In a very vivid and a very powerful way. But I want to think for a few minutes. I don't know how much time we've got left. 20 minutes, we're in good. I want to think about Jeremiah's response. Because sometimes Jeremiah resists this call to preach. And it is a challenging message that God gives him right from the very beginning. It is a negative message that God gives him. And what you see running throughout the book of Jeremiah is you see that from time to time, Jeremiah complains to God about his suffering. He complains about the rejection of the people. Jeremiah clearly loves his country and loves his people, and he did not want them to have to endure the catastrophe that was coming. There are strong notes of anguish and melancholy in Jeremiah's preaching. There are strong notes of anger and wrath in some of Jeremiah's preaching. The reader gets some feeling of the dilemma of the prophet who must accept the call and yet is overwhelmed by the experience in chapter 20 and verse 7. I'll come back and say more about that passage in just a few moments. Jeremiah prophesied during the very tragic period leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians. He denounced the Jews for forsaking God and His law and turning to idolatry. He called on the people to surrender and submit to Babylonian punishment for their sins, for which he was viewed as a traitor. Even though he spoke of the destruction of the Jewish nation, though, he emphasized the temporary nature of the destruction. And he looked to the return of the Jews to their land. Jeremiah certainly must have had a bad reputation. And I have the word reputation in my notes in parentheses. I almost used air quotes, but I would have hated myself if I had done that. But he certainly must have had a bad reputation among the people for this negative message that he was preaching. And two of my favorite passages in the book of Jeremiah are these. Jeremiah chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. Oh, that my head were waters, and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people. Oh, that I had in the desert a traveler's lodging place, that I might... You understand what he's saying there is, I wonder if there's a Motel 6 franchise somewhere on the road that I could purchase and I could manage this motel. Just get me out of town. Get me out of Dodge. Get me out of Jerusalem. Oh, that I had in the desert a traveler's lodging place, that I might leave my people and go away from them. There are some men in this room, maybe every man in this room, sometime at some point in your life has felt the same way about the work that you were doing in a local church. I have. I will say that. I won't speak for anybody else. I'm not asking for testimony. But there have been times when I said to my wife, I think maybe I just need to hang it up and go find something else to do. I don't feel like my message is being received. I don't feel like I'm being effective in the work that I'm doing. I love that I can relate to Jeremiah in passages like this, in ways that I can't relate to almost any of the other prophets, because I've felt this way before. And of course, the most famous passage, I think, is the one in chapter 20. If I say I will not mention him or speak any more in his name, there is in my heart, as it were, a burning fire shut up in my bones, and I am weary with holding it in, and I cannot. Listen. I'm thinking about just leaving Jerusalem and going and opening a lodging place for travelers, for wayfaring men. I can't do it. I can't do it. God has given me this message, and I've got to preach it. And so he calls it a fire in his bones. And so it's considerably easier, again, for me to relate to Jeremiah than it is so many other characters in the Bible. And I hope the same thing is true of all of us, that we have that fire burning in our bones. I want to think for a few minutes about Jeremiah's character. And here's what I have in mind with this part of the lesson. What is there here for us? We are, and every man here, I believe, is doing the work of preaching the gospel. We are prophets in the sense that a prophet was someone who tells the word of God. Not prophets in the same sense exactly that Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel were, but we are prophets. We are preachers. We have been charged with the responsibility of proclaiming God's message to the world. Some of us are old enough, some of us in this room are old enough to have seen drastic changes taking place in the culture in which we live, in the place where we live. It is amazing to me, the cultural shift that has occurred in the last 50 years in the United States of America, and maybe especially even in the last 10 years. And somebody mentioned earlier in the day that we are living in a pagan culture. I agree with that absolutely. We are living in a pagan culture, very much like Jeremiah was confronted with, very much like the apostles were in the Greek and Roman world of the first century. Jeremiah did this work for 40 plus years. Again, with no wife, forbidden by God to engage in feasting, forbidden by God to even go to houses of mourning. Jeremiah does this work where he is viewed by people almost from the very beginning, if not from the very beginning, as an enemy of God's people, rather than someone who's going to deliver God's people. And yet he perseveres to the end. How did he do that? How did Jeremiah do that? What can we take from Jeremiah? And what I've come up with over the course of a long period of time is I've come up with five things. These are things that I think we need to be able to teach God's message, preach God's message, tell people what they need to hear in a culture where telling people what they need to hear is going to be considerably and more quickly opposed in the same way that Jeremiah's message was opposed, I'm afraid. What is it that Jeremiah had that enabled him to do this? Five things that I want to suggest to you that are important, at least to me. One of them, the first one, and these are not necessarily in order. This is not number one because I think this is the most important thing. I really think this is a collective thing, and probably the last one that I'm going to talk about, if I were prioritizing these, would be the most important. But Jeremiah was a sensitive man. He was a man of tears. J.B. Tidwell said about Jeremiah, he was of a sensitive nature, mild, timid, and inclined to melancholy. He was uncommonly bold and courageous, although it was unpopular and subjected him to hatred and even to suffering wrong. He is also called the weeping prophet. Johnny's going to talk to us about the Lamentations tomorrow. Looking forward very much to hearing that. In Lamentations chapter 3, the third lamentation, in chapter 3 and verse 1, Jeremiah describes himself as a man who has seen affliction. Jeremiah was a sensitive man. I quoted chapter 9, verses 1 and 2 early on. Let me quote it again. My anguish. I writhe in pain. Oh, the walls of my heart. My heart is beating wildly. I cannot keep silent. What is it that is causing Jeremiah this emotional grief? He says, "For I hear the sound of the trumpet. The alarm of war. Crash follows hard on crash. The whole land is laid waste." Jeremiah is preaching a very unpopular message. And it's unpopular to him too. He doesn't want this to happen to these people. He doesn't take any joy. Have you ever, none of you have, but have you ever known someone? Somebody had done something really bad and they got what was coming to them. And you know somebody whose response to that was, "Yes, good. I'm glad they're suffering. I'm glad they got what was coming to them." If anybody ever deserved what was coming to them, it was the citizens of Judah and the citizens of Jerusalem. And Jeremiah knew exactly what was coming and it made him cry. It made him weep. It didn't give him any joy at all. I know positively that Jeremiah would have done anything that he could have done to keep this from happening. He was a sensitive man. He was a man who has seen affliction, but he was someone who was very much concerned about what was happening to other people. In chapter 13, I'm not going to turn there, but in chapter 13, he mentions pride as one of the problems in Judah and in Jerusalem, especially in verse 9. And this is the account in Jeremiah chapter 13 of the soiled loincloth, the soiled girdle that is buried and then dug up. Look at Jeremiah's response to that. Jeremiah says, "But if you will not listen, if you will not listen, then forget you. If you will not listen, it's on your own head. If you will not listen, at least I'm free from it." That's not what he said, is it? If you won't listen, then you're going to get just what's coming to you. What he said was in verse 17, "If you will not listen, my soul will weep in secret for your pride. My eyes will weep bitterly and run down with tears because the Lord's flock has been taken captive." We need that kind of tender heart. We need that kind of sensitivity. The people with whom we are dealing and with whom we have sometimes strong and powerful disagreements are people who are souls that are valuable to God above everything else. God is not willing that any should perish. May we all have the tender, sensitive hearts of Jeremiah. I'm confident that every man in here has shed tears over the spiritual condition of someone you were trying to influence, someone you were trying to teach. Let me suggest to you, secondly, along the same line, Jeremiah is a man of sympathy. He knew what it meant to be persecuted. He knew what it meant to be rejected. He knew what it meant to be lonely. Remember, he wasn't allowed to marry and have a family, even though we're told in chapter 16 that God did that to spare him from additional grief. It's still challenging to me to imagine how he could do that without a godly wife standing beside him. I preached in, I will say this because many of you know my wife, Susan. I preached in Jackson, Tennessee for 23 years. And I get asked all the time, how is it that you stayed in Jackson, Tennessee for 23 years? And my response, not tongue-in-cheek, there were many times during that 23 years the brethren would have been happy to show me the highway if I would have agreed to leave Susan behind, if I would have left her there. They put up with me for 23 years so that they could have her as part of that work. I know you all feel the exact same way about your wives. Jeremiah is denied that. We've already quoted Jeremiah chapter 4, verses 19 and 20. Look at chapter 8, verses 18 through 22. Jeremiah says, "My joy is gone. My grief is upon me. My heart is sick within me. Behold, the cry of the daughter of my people from the length and breadth of the land. Is the Lord not in Zion? Is her king not in her? Why have they provoked me to anger with their carved images and their foreign idols? The harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. For the wound of the daughter of my people is my heart wounded. I mourn and dismay has taken hold of me. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then has the health of the daughter of my people not been restored?" He was sympathetic to these people. He wasn't angry with them. He wasn't upset with them to the point that he wanted to see them suffer. May God give us sympathetic hearts in dealing with people, especially who oppose us and make the work that we try to do in preaching and teaching God's Word more difficult. I suggest to you, number three, that Jeremiah was a man of courage. There's no particular passage in the book of Jeremiah that I would put my finger on and say this is an example of courage. I think many passages, the fact that he was able to just go and do what he did implies to me courage, knowing what it was going to cost him. He was told in the very beginning in chapter 1, "But you, dress yourself for work. Arise and say to them everything that I command you. Do not be dismayed by them, lest I dismay you before them." And then God says in verse 18, "Behold, I make you this day a fortified city, an iron pillar, bronze walls against the whole land." We talked about that a little bit earlier. 40 years, Jeremiah never one time fails to go and do what God tells him to do. Never one time does he fail to deliver the message that God tells him to deliver. That makes Jeremiah a man of courage. Brethren, I think some of us have lived in an era of history that's almost unprecedented, and we've lived in a place in history that is almost unprecedented. For most of my preaching life, I have been able to proclaim the message of God as I saw it, without any fear at all of retribution. I think that's changing. Thank God that we've lived through that period of time. Now, let's hope that God gives us the strength to face the same kind of opposition that Jeremiah faced, because I think that's going to happen. And we may have to, let me touch on this. He had overwhelming and unshakable faith and conviction in God. He goes out and buys a field. Pays a lot of money for the field with conviction that God is going to bring the people back. He put his confidence and his trust in God. But I want us to think for a few minutes about the fact that Jeremiah was a man of prayer. I owe this section to Cloyce. Cloyce came to Eastside here in Bowling Green and preached for us. And he talked to us about Jeremiah. And one of the messages that he preached, and I highly commend it, was the fact that Jeremiah was a man of prayer. As a matter of fact, this is his slide, I think, which I have shamelessly appropriated. and Cloyce talked to us about the tough prayers that he prayed. At least 14 times in the book of Jeremiah, we are told that Jeremiah talked with God. He prayed. It's impressive to take that list that's in the outline and to go through and to just notice how prominent, how important a part of Jeremiah's life prayer was. And they weren't all the classic examples of the kind of sanitized prayer that characterized the prayer life sometimes of God's people today. The prayers that we have recorded in the book of Jeremiah very often reflect his frustration. very often reflect his discouragement, his anger, his bitterness over the things that are happening to him in life. And one of the examples that I want us to think about and in the last couple of minutes, and maybe we can talk about this in the question and answer session too, but it's Jeremiah chapter 20 and verse 7. O Lord, you have deceived me, and I was deceived. You are stronger than I, and you have prevailed. I have become a laughingstock all the day. Everyone mocks me. Some commentators would suggest that a lot of modern English Bible translations are weak in the way that they translate passages like this. And here's what I mean by that. There is a Hebrew word. It is translated deceived. This is an English Standard Version translation. It's translated deceived. There, I won't try to pronounce the name of the word. But in the same word appears in Exodus chapter 22 and verse 16. Patah, is that close to right, patah? That word appears in Exodus chapter 22 and verse 16. And in that context, in Exodus 22, it's used for enticing a woman to engage in sexual intercourse, engaging a woman in sexual intercourse with whom you are not married. But in Exodus chapter 22, she submits willingly. What's translated stronger than I? You are stronger than I. The New American Standard says you have overcome me. Chazak, something like that is the Hebrew word. Is that relatively close? That carries the idea of overcoming or prevailing by means of strength. And the interesting thing about that is that word that's translated you are stronger than I in the English Standard Version, that word is used in Deuteronomy 22 and verse 25 to refer to forcing a woman against her will to have sexual intercourse with you. And so a work by a man named Abraham Heschel was called to my attention. I don't know anything about his background at all. H-E-C-H-E-L, I think. And it's in the bibliography. I had to go to the Western Kentucky Library to find the book and to look this up. But here's Heschel's proposed translation of Jeremiah chapter 20 and verse 7. Heschel says that it should be translated like this, that it's Jeremiah saying, O Lord, thou hast seduced me and I am seduced. Thou hast raped me and I am overcome. That's powerful. That's powerful. The paraphrase would be something like, the paraphrase would be, God, you have deliberately deceived me. You have overpowered me and had your way with me. Ray Stedman says about this verse that this cry is on the verge of blasphemy. Prayer. In prayer, you know, Jeremiah gets angry. Jeremiah gets frustrated. Jeremiah gets bitter. Where does he pour that out? Where does he pour that out? Does he pour that out against his friends? He didn't have many. He couldn't afford to lose any, I suppose, could he? Does he pour it out against the people to whom he's preaching? No. He takes it to God. These imprecatory expressions are an important part of how Jeremiah dealt with the relationship that he had with God. I'll share a couple of other things with you in the question and answer session. But those five things, I hope, those five things are some things that we can take as preachers. And maybe especially as we move forward in a world, in a culture, where more and more just preaching the simple, pure message of God is going to stir up opposition. And maybe the same kind of opposition from time to time that Jeremiah had to face. Thank you all very much.